Hello, I'm Ed Butler. Welcome to the download of Business Daily, where this week we strike a pose for the profligate world of fashion design. Recession? What recession?
We had Russians walking into our shops in Stockholm and Finland coming out of Russia and just putting down wads of money and saying, I want the most expensive thing in the shop.
Also in the programme, how gazing at a woman's skirt could provide a clue to the global economy.
With the recession in 2009, we predicted ankle-length skirts in 2012.
That's a high-rolling leg forecasting Business Daily from the BBC. Now, every now and then on the programme, we do like to reflect on those businesses that seem to cruise untroubled through the choppy waters of a global slowdown. Chocolate sales, for instance, are said to be recession-proof. Beer, it's claimed, will always be needed, no matter how tight the squeeze. Well, perhaps one surprising addition to the list is designer fashion. Yes, the models, the fashionistas, have generally been strutting, posing and seeming pretty pleased with themselves in New York and London this week, the opening fashion weeks of the season. This is where the industry gets to celebrate its immense good fortune. The major labels of London, Paris and Milan have been flourishing as the economies around them teeter on the brink of disaster. That's because, apparently, the rich have just kept spending, unlike the rest of us. Or at least they were until this year, when signs of a Chinese slowdown seemed to have caused something of a pout on the fashionistas' lips. The UK luxury giant Burberry is one brand to have warned of lower profits amid weakening demand from the Far East. Is it a sign of the times? I caught up with Roger Saul, founder of the British luxury brand Mulberry, who now has his own retail designer outlet, Kilver Court, in the west of England. I asked him what he was seeing.
It has expanded at an almost unstoppable rate during what's been one of the worst world recessions any of us have ever experienced. So inevitably, it was going to hit the buffers at some point. And you've got a mature brand like Burberry that, you know, even when I started Mulberry back in the 70s, Burberry was massive in places like Japan and the States. So it's a very mature luxury brand that has had several renaissances over the last 20 years. But they have been in those markets and were one of the first into China and around the world. If you look at that, that means that they're almost one of the ones that's going to find it harder to replace market retreat with fresh market position in what's a sort of pretty full world now. So places like Africa and some of the other markets that are coming up, like Nigeria, for example, probably will be a good small luxury goods market over the next 10 years. But barely is going to dent a shop or two in China from Burberry's perspective.
I look at East Asia and I can see how that market will, perhaps because of its cultural traditions, be intrigued, be fascinated by Europe and the United States for what it offers in terms of fashion, in terms of couture, in terms of brand status. I'm wondering if other emerging parts of the world, such as Latin America or Africa, will have the same attitude about European chic.
I think they probably will, but it was quite interesting watching when, sort of early 90s, when Russia really started being a major consumer. And we opened our first shops, Mulberry shops, in Russia. And it was almost like a gold rush of Russian wealthy, recently wealthy people coming into the market, not really understanding what they wanted. I mean, we had Russians walking into our shops in Stockholm and Finland, just putting down wads of money and saying, I want the most expensive thing in the shop. That is not quite the same as going to happen in Nigeria and places like that, but it will be the next step on from that initially, as these new markets struggle to understand what is presented to them as a luxury good that helps them demonstrate and enjoy their wealth.
So how has the fashion changed? I'm curious, in the context of this recession, at least in Europe and the United States, the sense of a slowdown, the sense of people, the middle-range person or the average middle-class consumer not being able to afford as much. How has that registered itself in terms of the fashion? What is fashionable?
We really haven't seen a slowdown in the luxury goods sector until now. And that slowdown is a slowdown of growth, I would suggest, rather than going backwards fast. So you could really say that it's sailed through pretty well so far. As you head further down, the middle market is always absolutely bashed when you get a recession. I would suggest the more mature brands will find it a bit tougher now and harder to keep finding those new markets. But there are quite a few younger brands bashing hard, and fashion is as exciting as ever. You know, it's not going backwards.
Is fashion, though, reflecting the recession in what it sells?
What you tend to get during these times is you'll get a little bit more of a menswear feeling come in, where it is a little bit more tailored. I mean, we've heard about button up to the neck rather than exposed bosom sort of thing. So I think you'll see a little bit more austerity in that sense. But there's still some wild stuff out there at an amazing sort of black and silver futuristic Prada, Gucci sort of feeling. And then we hit 2000, and that was very much let's look back into the past. And in fashion terms, the 70s was very much the developing time for fashion brands and fashion itself, so that was the target. And of course, British brands like mine, Mulberry, was at its peak in that sense of being new and fresh. So, and that was all, I mean, I was using constantly that reference back to hunting, shooting, fishing, to military, to colonialism, and all of those things that you could draw in from all around the world, because England had been involved in places around the world.
Is fashion cheaper than it was? Or is the point about fashion that it's at its high end, it's always there to filter and separate people from the crowd?
Well, I would think some young and old ladies would be spluttering in their tea, as you said, is fashion cheaper? Because fashion is, at the top end, incredibly more expensive. If I think 2003-04, as I came out of Mulberry and went farming, there were our sort of average handbag price was probably £350. I would say now at Mulberry it's £750. So it really has knocked on a pace, and that means margins are higher, and the brands are accumulating more profit in that sense. If you look at the other end, there's a big gap from top to bottom. So if you look at brands like Jack Wills, if you like, at the top end of the younger market, they would sit very well priced for the consumer. Still sort of, you know, relatively expensive, but the price bracket has been secured through very good sourcing around the world. So I would say there's plenty of margin in there for the brands, but on a sort of accessible level, fashion is very well priced. At the top level, it's almost absurd.
We're in the throes now of the end of the New York Fashion Week, the start of the London Fashion Week. Do you see the different demographics being targeted by those events? Is that what they're there for?
Well, London, Paris, New York particularly, and Milan, those are the big fashion capitals where all of the international journalists come in to see the collection. So, yes, this is an absolutely critical time, and you've got all the, you know, MSN now has come doing a whole Fashion Week report. And you're going to see that information flashed ever faster around the world to all those markets, which means they're all going to see faster than ever before what's happening in the fashion world. And it really is a very, very key few weeks. And the success and failure of fashion is based on what happens in those sort of 3-4 weeks.
That's Roger Saul, founder of the luxury brand Mulberry. You're listening to Business Daily from the BBC with Ed Butler. So there's one commercial view of the fashion industry. More now on the fashion itself. The hemline index is a theory which dates back to the 1920s. This predicts that when the economy is good, the line of a woman's skirt will rise. Think miniskirts in the booming 1960s, for instance. When the economy is struggling, hemlines fall. So what about now? Professor Philip Hans Francis of the Erasmus School of Economics in Rotterdam has made a living of late gazing at women's legs, and he's updated the stats for the 21st century.
What is new in our research is that we are the first to effectively compile a database with actual figures, and apparently nobody has ever done so.
You've produced very hard, concrete data to back up this correlation, and it stands the test, does it?
We collected data at the monthly level from a French fashion magazine called L'Officiel. 2 years ago, they put all of their previous issues on the web, so you can just stroll through them and have a look at all the previous issues, and that goes back to 1921.
And so by this measure, you can actually produce to the very centimetre, perhaps to the very millimetre, the length of a standard hemline year by year.
Well, we could have done that, but that would be a little bit too complicated. So we decided to divide the hemlines into five categories, from very short to very long, so to speak. And we compiled monthly data and associated that with economic prosperity.
And without fail, it does correspond to the state, relatively, of the Western economy.
Yes. Well, it doesn't correlate right now, because that was one of the interesting findings. There is a time delay. So when we wrote our initial paper, that was in 2010, we predicted that the time delay is, in fact, 3 years, that with the recession in 2009, we predicted ankle-length skirts in 2012. The reason that people usually think that hemlines and or fashion is correlated with the economy has to do with, say, some kind of a state of happiness, which is if people are more happy, then perhaps they dress in a more happy way, so to speak. Other people suggest that it has to do with, in economic times, people should be careful about how they look, that they don't lose jobs and things like that, or make a very serious impression when they try to get a job.
You suggested that there is a three-year delay here, so I guess that perhaps answers the big question, which is whether fashions merely reflect the economic mood, or whether to some extent they might even predict it.
No, it's indeed the first situation. So the economy today predicts hemlines in the next for 3 years from now, and it's not the other way around. So if we think, because that was quite interesting to see that in 2010 we had very short skirts, and people say, well, this must be the case because we have this economic boom. But we didn't have that. It was just a mild recovery, but we did have a boom in 2007.
Right. So, I mean, because, of course, farmers famously consult their pigs, don't they, to discover what the weather's going to be tomorrow. We shouldn't be sneaking up on models at London or New York Fashion Week just to, with our tape measures, just to see what their hemlines are looking like.
No. So current hemlines have no predictive value, but current economy has.
I suppose, though, what is true is that there is... mood is an important reflector, isn't it? I mean, mood is an indicator of the future course of an economy. And perhaps to that extent, what happens in fashion could be an interesting and slightly uncharted barometer of how people are feeling and are going to go on feeling in terms of confidence.
Yes, well, part of it, because our econometric model is not explaining fully what the current hemline is doing. So something like 40% of the variation is explained. And the other 60 could very well be mood or weather or other kinds of happiness. And perhaps that is also part of the explanation.
Another reason there to gaze at models' legs, Professor Philip Hans Francis of the Erasmus School of Economics in Rotterdam. Tech junkies around the world have this week been feverishly awaiting the launch of Apple's new iPhone 5, the latest must-have gadget for some. The African media was there with others publishing leaked details of the phone ahead of the launch, showing that there's practically no limit to the reach of the latest kit. But as our regular Kenyan commentator Wycliffe Muga now reports, it's one thing to have a top-range cell phone, quite another to use it.
When you have long been accustomed to being many years behind the industrialized nations in all aspects of technology and infrastructure, it's a welcome surprise when, in the case of something like mobile phones, you quite suddenly not only have access to the very latest technology available, but you have also found new ways of using it. Several years ago, if you wanted to call a relative or friend, you had to rely on Africa's old state-owned telephone companies, which only offered hard-to-get and inefficient landlines. So when the new wave of easily available and affordable mobile phone services provided by the private telecoms corporations came in, it was seen as something of a technological miracle, since the invention of mobile phone-based money transfers. But now this miracle is proving to have its limits. Here in Kenya, the fierce competition for mobile phone subscribers over the past few years led to a continuing reduction in the cost of phone calls. Good for the consumer, but some mobile phone companies warned that with such slim margins, they would not be able to build the transmitting stations necessary for handling the growing numbers of phone users. Hence, they would be serving the ever-increasing numbers of customers with more or less the same infrastructure, leading to a less reliable service. But most Kenyans did not care about this. What mattered was that those calls cost less and less with time, allowing everyone to talk more and more. And it's not just a matter of official or business calls. Indeed, business calls, in my view, make up a very small part of Kenyan phone calls. With our elaborate extended family systems, we always have plenty of people we need to talk to very often. It's in the evenings, after working hours, that the phone lines get seriously clogged, with Friday evenings being notoriously the time when it's hardest to get a call through. And now, the effects of the mobile phone companies not being able to invest in improved capacity has become all too obvious. Where just a few years ago, you were more or less guaranteed clear connections and no dropped calls, today our calls are dropped all the time, especially if the call is placed to someone whose phone is not on the same network as yours. And even if you do get through, there is no guarantee you will get a clear signal at all. I could give a personal example. Kenya had an outbreak of violence in 2008 following a bitterly contested presidential election. Roadblocks of burning tires were set up by rioting youths, and I could not be sure of safely making my way to the BBC studio in the coastal town of Mombasa, where I lived at the time. I was able to record a discussion of the economic impact of this chaos safely from my apartment over the phone. The calls were clear and reliable enough for that back then. Nowadays, of course, there could be no question of recording anything of that kind using a mobile phone. The swift expansion and low prices that have led to almost half of Kenya's 40 million people owning a mobile phone have come at a cost. Between the poor signal quality and the frequently dropped calls, making calls on mobile phones here in Kenya is not as much fun as it used to be. This is Wycliffe Muga for the BBC World Service in Nairobi.
Well, at least we're still audible, I hope. If you've got views on hemlines or anything else, do share them with us. Our email address is world.business@bbc.co.uk, or there's the Facebook page. You never know, it could just prove a fashion trend.